Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the flashing of the Nixon victory sign by Nixon and Trump's dirty trickster Roger Stone as Stone leaves federal courthouses, which, intentionally or not, links President Nixon to Trump and the Mueller investigation to Watergate, which ended with Nixon resigning to avoid impeachment. Corey Brettschneider, a professor of political science at Brown University and the author of The Oath and the Office, A Guide to the Constitution for Future Presidents, joins us to discuss how a candidate who cheated and undermined an election is unfit to take the oath of office to defend the Constitution. And if Trump cheated on his way to the presidency, he betrayed his oath of office to defend the basic laws that underlie our system of government. We'll look into what could happen once it becomes clear that Trump gained the presidency by foul as opposed to fair means, and what mechanisms exist in the Constitution to deal with an illegitimate president in terms of an election do-over, short of the grounds for impeachment spelled out in the Constitution citing high crimes and misdemeanors. Then we'll assess the impact of yesterday's testimony before the Senate Intelligence Committee by the country's top intelligence officials delivering their annual global threat assessments, in which they contradicted President Trump at every turn. Kent Harrington, a former senior CIA analyst who served as National Intelligence Officer for East Asia and helped prepare prior reports to Congress, joins us to discuss the most alarming aspects of the testimony, that Russia and China are working closer together against the United States as Trump alienates our allies and insults and divisive trade wars. And since after the testimony, Trump lashed out at the intelligence chief, calling them passive and naive, tweeting they should go back to school, we will gauge the reaction of the intelligence community. Then finally, we'll explore the right-wing media universe for signs of fissures following stinging criticism of Trump from Ann Coulter and other Fox News and Breitbart pundits who excoriated him for caving to Nancy Pelosi over the shutdown without getting his wall. Matt Gertz, a senior fellow at Media Matters, where he writes extensively on media ethics and the Trump-Fox feedback loop, joins us to discuss his article, Trump's Propagandists Go to War with Each Other After He Caves on the Shutdown, and how more and more Trump is following the policy advice offered by Fox and Friends and other Fox pundits he watches for hours each day. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is Corey Brettschneider, who's a professor of political science at Brown University, where he teaches constitutional law and politics, as well as a visiting professor of law at Fordham Law School. His writing has appeared in Time, Politico, and the New York Times, and he is the author of the new book, The Oath and the Office, A Guide to the Constitution for Future Presidents. Welcome to Background Briefing, Corey Brettschneider.
Thank you. Always a pleasure to speak with you.
Well, thank you, Corey. And there are a couple of things today that happened that I wanted to mention, one of which is that we've heard for some time about a state-owned company resisting Mueller's subpoenas. It looks very much like that is a Russian company. But the other news flash today, we've heard, of course, Corey, that God works in mysterious ways. Well, now we're learning, according to Sarah Sanders, God wanted Trump to become president. She said to the Christian Broadcasting Network, quote, "I think God calls all of us to fill different roles at different times, and I think that he wanted Donald Trump to become president, and that's why he's there." So that settles that, hey?
Yes. I mean, you know, on the one hand, it's sort of a, speaks to the way that he'll cater and she'll cater to this particular constituency in whatever way they want. But it also, to me, speaks to his complete disregard. I mean, it's not even a moment for the idea in this country that's enshrined in the beginning, after all, of our First Amendment, that Congress shall make no law establishing official religion, but also that, you know, the president is supposed to respect this idea that we don't have a sort of religious litmus test. And so the just sort of basic way that he'll both pander and also reason in a way that's really contrary to the spirit of the Constitution. It's a symbol, I think, of the deeper problems that we're in.
So in other words, Trump's against all of the the points in the First Amendment, which is separation of church and state and freedom of the press, because he would like to change the libel laws, as we know. So turning to the latest to and fro over Mueller, and we've got this unbelievable toxic clown out there, Roger Stone, making lots of noises. But in general, what's your sense of questions that I raised in the opening about is there any – I mean, as it becomes more and more likely that this election, as Trump said, it was going to be rigged because he was preparing to lose, and then he would have gone around the country leading rallies of lock her up, lock her up. And I think he was surprised as much as anybody that he won. But then he said that, you know, to explain the disparity where there were 3 million more votes for Hillary Clinton, he said that 3 million Hispanics voted illegally. But in general, what is the situation if it's proven that a president is elected by illegal or illicit means? There is no provision, is there? Is there for a do-over?
We're in some ways unprecedented, but the Nixon precedents, I think, do help us, and that's what's so eerie about Stone, you know, waving his hands like this and invoking Nixon and his Nixon tattoo, is that that's our best guide. And, you know, the special prosecutor in that case, after the Saturday Night Massacre, did pretty well by forcing these subpoenas and continuing a criminal investigation until that president resigned. And here I think we've got two tracks at least, and then I'll mention a third. The first is that, you know, this investigation could continue, and as the evidence turns up, the circle starts to close in towards Trump. Now, there's a live debate about whether or not Mueller could actually indict the president while he's in office, and there are these Justice Department memos that suggest that he cannot. But on my view, you know, and I hope that Mueller is thinking about this, and increasingly scholars are with me. I think it was a small group in the beginning, but now I'd say scholars are split. I think that when you really look at the Nixon-era precedents, and you look at U.S. v. Nixon in particular, where they said a president is not above the law and has to answer a criminal subpoena, that those precedents, regardless of what these Justice Department memos suggest, do support the idea that Mueller could indict the president if he's committed crimes while in office. And if they're this serious, I think he absolutely should consider it. Now, if that doesn't happen, he could file a report with the House Judiciary Committee, and they could begin impeachment proceedings. And during the Nixon era, they did, in the committee, vote several articles of impeachment, and then that's what caused Nixon to resign. So it has to, in my view, what the report contains, the serious allegations that we believe it does, and we've seen bits and pieces that suggest that this is historic in its violation, both of the criminal law and, as you said in the intro, of the oath of office. Absolutely, I think that the House has a duty to begin impeachment investigation.
So the problem there is that impeachment by nature is a bipartisan undertaking.
Right. Well, they don't need bipartisanship in the House. Ideally, they would get some and get some on the committee as they did during the Nixon era and bring people on board. The worry, of course, politically, is that they wouldn't have the votes in the Senate, given that you need a supermajority, and that would, of course, require a serious sliver of Republican votes. But, you know, part of what happened during Nixon is that over time the support for impeaching him grew as that investigation brought more things to light. And I think that's part of what would happen here, that if Mueller doesn't indict, but he provides this report, that would be the basis for hearings and the American people to hear what happened. And if Congress does its job, if the House Judiciary Committee does its job, they'll teach America about why really intervening in collaborating with a foreign government, with Russia, whose interests, of course, are not with our own, isn't just, it's beyond a crime, really. It is a threat. I called it, in a CNN article, an existential threat to American democracy, and it is, because after all, if we don't have free and fair elections, in what sense are we a legitimate government at all? And the president, the leader of our country, if he's collaborated in trying to undermine our elections, he's done more, maybe, than anyone in history to undermine American democracy, the idea of consent of the governed. And so there is a duty, I think, to bring this to light, and not just to cater, but to teach the American people, and eventually, yes, to put pressure on that sliver of Republicans and to appeal to their decency to get them to vote to remove this really historically terrible precedent. And terrible isn't quite the word. It's the flouting and the demeaning of the office is, I think, much worse, actually, than Nixon, as bad as that was.
And again, I'm speaking with Corey Brett Schneider, who's a professor of political science at Brown University, where he teaches constitutional law and politics, as well as a visiting professor of law at Fordham Law School. His writings appeared in Time, Politico, and the New York Times, and he is the author of the new book, The Oath and the Office, A Guide to the Constitution for Future Presidents. Now, if you were in Hillary Clinton's shoes, Corey, and it came out that Trump cheated, the Russians helped him, and Mueller has all the proof, wouldn't she be clamoring for a do-over? Isn't that her right?
Yeah. I mean, morally, I could see that. And, you know, she clearly deserved to win the election if this all turns out to be true, because, you know, he benefited from these illegal acts. But I think, you know, it is a constitutional crisis, because the person with the most power in the country, as was the case in Nixon, is actively seeking to undermine the rule of law. So I think it's even more important that we follow the rules and the procedures that are laid out. And I think that includes, as I said, the possibility of an indictment, even while he's in office. But it also certainly includes the impeachment procedure. So I think that we can't just declare a do-over. I think we've got to go through what's outlined. And, you know, in times of this kind of instability, when those foundations of the country are being shook, I'd love to see a do-over and to do what the moral thing is, but I think we've got to stick with the rule of law and the letter of the law, the way the framers gave it to us. But, you know, I also, frankly, am lobbying and arguing that it is also Mueller's duty to bring a criminal indictment. During Nixon, by the way, the precedent, despite these memos, they considered very seriously the possibility of indicting Nixon, but they decided, you know what, the quickest way to get him out is to basically negotiate through the impeachment procedures. But some combination of this also could happen. Mueller could use the office to try to negotiate a settlement where Trump would step down and perhaps do some jail time. You know, there are a lot of incentives there. For instance, the investigation of the family members that might come with one big package. So that's a third possibility, I guess, that I mentioned from the outset.
So I'm sure you caught the acting attorney general, the woefully unqualified and ethically challenged Whitaker, who was sweating profusely and obviously not used to journalists. And when he was asked a question about the status of the Mueller inquiry, he said, one, that he had been briefed on it, and two, that it would be coming out very soon, or closing, it would be finished up very soon. Right. And then on top of that, we learned that the vote on Barr's confirmation to be the new attorney general had been delayed. Is there anything going on behind the scenes there?
You know, one thing that we even saw during the Barr hearings, and is, again, reminiscent of this eerie parallel in the 1970s, is a lot of questions about whether or not Mueller would be fired. And my understanding is that any vote to confirm a new attorney general is going to be contingent on those promises, like what was made during the Watergate era. And the only reason, historically, that Elliot Richardson refused to fire the special prosecutor, the Mueller of the time, Archibald Cox, and why he himself, you know, insisted on being fired before, instead of him doing that, is because he had promised the Senate that he wouldn't do it. And so that's why, you know, watching these hearings, making sure that these promises are made is so important. Certainly no senator, Republican or Democrat, should vote to confirm this new attorney general without an assurance that Mueller will be protected. Ideally, we'd have a law that protected him from being fired, but, you know, this is the second best, I think, that we can hope for.
Well, Senators Blumenthal and Chairman Grassley have put forth a bill calling for transparency and protection of Mueller. I can't imagine Trump would sign that, but on the other hand, would he be forced to?
I've been arguing for this Protect Mueller bill as sort of the shorthand, and the leader McConnell has been the one to block it, despite the fact that there's clear bipartisan support for it. Mm-hmm. And every chance I get, I urge senators to not back down. And you know, there was a moment where Jeff Flake was threatening to hold up judicial nominees, and of course, that unless it was brought to the floor, that didn't work. So we need a new sort of strategy. Flake flagrantly failed there, but yes, I'm hoping that the Protect Mueller bill becomes part of our dialogue. But at minimum, we need this second best commitment by an attorney general to protect it. But you know, as I guess you're getting at, that promise is not a matter of law. We really need to enshrine in the idea that. The ideal of the president not being above the law by making sure that people investigating him or her are protected from being fired for political reasons. And right now, the truth is there's a lot of vulnerability. I think, you know, in a way we're benefiting about from the existing interim attorney general, Mr. Whitaker, is so far beyond his capacity. He's made all sorts of bizarre statements about judicial review and Marbury versus Madison and not believing in our system of courts, that he's really discredited himself and showed himself to be a lightweight. And I think Mueller, I have to believe, and those in the Justice Department know how to keep him at arm's length. So I think we're safe now, but we've got to really shore up the protection of this investigation, because we need to know what this president did, especially when it comes to the, as I said, existential threat to our democracy of collaborating with a foreign government.
But just in the last couple of minutes, are you saying, Corey Bruchschneider, that the reason that the vote on Barr's confirmation to become the attorney general has been delayed might have something to do with the majority of the Senate wanting a pledge from him to protect Mueller, which he didn't give in the hearings, in the questioning?
I guess I don't know that for sure, but I'm speculating that might be part of the holdup. And more than that, I guess I'm making a point about what should be, that I hope that this delay is used to get that guarantee, because I think without it, in a very clear way, the country is in real trouble. So I have no inside information about what's going on behind the scenes, but looking historically at what happened at a similar moment when an attorney general was being confirmed, that was the play. It was to get that commitment, and that's what senators should be doing right now.
Well, just in closing, do you think that Whitaker gave accurate information when he said Mueller is close to finishing?
I don't think he knows. I mean, I think that this the Office of the Special Counsel is not protected as a matter of law, but there are regulations guaranteeing and stating its independence. And, you know, those are internal regulations to the executive branch. They don't have the power of law. They're not subject to judicial review. They don't give rise to judicial review of courts, an independent body, in the way that a law would. But they are enough to sort of give a kind of ballast, I think, to the Mueller investigation. And so I think they're keeping him, my understanding is they're keeping him at arm's length, and he's not dominating this investigation the way that a stronger Trump ally might, who also was not out of his depth in the way that Whitaker is.
Well, Corey Bruchschneider, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure. Always great to talk to you, and thanks for the great work that you're doing.
Well, thank you, Corey. And again, I've been speaking with Corey Bruchschneider, a professor of political science at Brown University, where he teaches constitutional law and politics, as well as a visiting professor of law at Fordham Law School. His writing has appeared in Time, Politico, and the New York Times, and he is the author of the new book, The Oath and the Office, a guide to the Constitution for future presidents. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back looking into how the intel chiefs warned that Trump is driving Russia and China together.
It's coming from the field that this ain't exactly real, or it's real, but it ain't exactly there. From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Kent Harrington, a former senior CIA analyst who was National Intelligence Officer for East Asia and Chief of Station in Asia. And he has an article at Project Syndicate, Trump's North Korean Road to Nowhere. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kent Harrington.
Thanks, Ian, and good afternoon.
Good afternoon or good evening to you on the East Coast. So, Kent, the intel chiefs were yesterday, they contradicted Donald Trump at every turn, giving their annual global threat assessment. And you have prepared some of those reports in the past. What was your sense of the – let's start with the pushback from Trump calling them passive and naive and saying they should go back to school?
Well, Ian, I think all of this was foretold 150 years ago, and Lewis Carroll did it best in Alice in Wonderland with the line from the Queen, what I tell you three times is true. The Trump reaction is very much in character, but quite frankly, debating his view versus the intelligence community's perspective on threats facing the United States, something they look at intensively 24/7 and provide to Congress as well as the administration, is kind of like a question often asked if someone starts to have an argument with a fool. They need to take care because after a while, people have a hard time telling the difference. I think the pushback from Trump is obvious. It's contradicting the reality that the intelligence world is attempting to present in a report that they're required to present. It isn't a matter of lèse majeste or attempting to undermine the administration. The intelligence reforms of the 1970s required them to brief the oversight committees annually on threats facing the country, something that would be a good idea in any case. And this report reflected the distilled views of the entire intelligence community, presented in a way that could be made public so that voters, citizens would know what the thinking was based on all source intelligence collection and analysis. And I think what we're looking at here is something that really just is a reflection of the dysfunction of the government we have today. It isn't a reflection of anything untoward, unusual, or much less subversive on the part of the professionals that work in the community, nor the political appointees that Trump himself has selected to lead them. It's simply a matter of a president who has decided to take a certain course based on whatever whims or impulses drive him, confronting the reality of a government that is producing what it views to be its best possible view of the world that surrounds the United States. So the only thing I can say about the pushback is very simple, is it doesn't make any sense. And I hope as the stories unfold over the next several days and weeks that it will become clear what the grounding is beneath the intelligence community view, and the questions that are appropriate will be raised about why the president did and said what he said.
Well, we've never had a president who is more involved in his own world, his own ego, his own vanity, and his own craving for flattery. And he governs by reality television stunts. This is the most unqualified president one could ever imagine. And the comparison, since you worked in East Asia, the comparison with Nixon couldn't be more acute at this time, when the intelligence chiefs warn us that, in effect, Trump's policies are alienating allies with insults and unnecessary trade wars, and driving Russia and China further together, and they're cooperating more and more. That is exactly the opposite of what Nixon did in his opening to China. He put the United States in the Catbird seat, being able to play Russia off against China and vice versa. Now, the reverse is true. It would seem at least we're heading in that direction. So this is a case. And of course, the first thing that Trump did was tear up the TPP, which was a way to pressure China to become more of a member of the Democratic community. You notice that the minute the TPP went away, which was an effort to organize the neighborhood to force China to follow the rules. Now China is becoming more and more oppressive internally, with Xi Jinping bringing back the worst elements of the Communist Party repression. So, to my mind, this is an embarrassing moment, frankly.
Well, it's the latest of a series of embarrassments, to be sure. I think you're right about the alignment of China and Russia, which is, as you said in your observations, in part a reflection of what Trump himself has created, uncertainty in the environment in Asia that provides advantages to our strategic competitors that they can exploit. I would add simply that I think the alignment between Beijing and Moscow reflects internal politics in both countries in a way that's quite important as an influence on why they're moving in the direction they're moving. But indeed, it's opportunistic. And beyond that, it also is incrementally building a relationship that would not necessarily have been built in quite the same way had Trump not taken the steps that he's taken in Asia. I personally don't think he is off the mark, or his administration is off the mark in confronting China on a range of issues that have increasingly become obvious problems for us, whether in trade or, for that matter, with respect to their mercantilist economy. That having been said, to confront China, given its size and weight economically and strategically in Asia, without having aligned the allies on our side, is to begin to implement a strategy which, however appropriate for the moment the goals may be, in execution is almost doomed to fail. So I think the Trump administration is both helping the Chinese and the Russians at a certain level, but also failing in ways that it could succeed if it had taken a very different approach to alliance relationships in the Pacific region. And you put your finger on one leadership role that they immediately abdicated. Whether TPP as written was good or bad isn't the issue. It's the American role in leading the integration and the development of Asia as a successful economic region with us deeply embedded that they clearly are not keeping their eye on. But I also think your point about the success of previous administrations of managing great power relations is also correct. What we're looking at, quite frankly, is the consequences of an Asia, but also a Europe, that's having basic questions arise in the collective Asian and European minds about the U.S. and its staying power in the future. U.S. allies and partners, coincidentally, as the intelligence assessment that was presented to Congress suggested today or yesterday, U.S. allies and partners are seeking greater independence, in part because they literally don't know where their principal strategic partner, the United States, is going. So Trump is a catalyst for a variety of things that didn't need necessarily to happen. And I don't think anyone has yet got a good fix on what the consequences are going to be for us over the long term. But at this point, they're not going to be good.
And again, I'm speaking with Kent Harrington, a former CIA analyst who was National Intelligence Officer for East Asia. And he has an article at Project Syndicate, Trump's North Korean Road to Nowhere. And by the way, Kent, the rest of the countries in the TPP are continuing. Actually, the TPP survived, but obviously the U.S. not being in it is a big factor. And the fact that other nations are keeping it going indicates that they're benefiting from it, whereas the U.S. is not. But with Trump now talking about his meeting with Kim Jong-un sometime in February, in spite of what the intelligence had said about the fact that the North Koreans were essentially continuing their nuclear program, and they weren't going to give it up. And Gina Haspel, the head of the CIA, said that they're actually developing a new launch site for an ICBM, which could reach the United States. And that, of course, is the main concern. That we know they have nuclear weapons, but the issue is, can they mate them on a missile that could reach the United States? So, again, we're talking about photo opportunities instead of statecraft.
I think that's right. I mean, there's no question that the results of the meeting in Singapore were not only less than meets the eye, but almost totally vacuous. The North Koreans, I think, have done a masterful job of playing this administration, not necessarily the people in the professional ranks, so to speak, who have an understanding of the history as well as the actions and even the intentions of the North Koreans, but the political establishment surrounding Trump that has, for whatever combination of reasons, gone along with his effort to claim that the progress made in Singapore in June actually was a durable foundation to get real results. The fact of the matter is it hasn't gotten results, and I think any reasonable person looking at where things are now and where they're likely to be at the end of February when the two meet, that is Kim and Trump, would conclude that it won't produce results. Let's just look at a couple basic facts. Number one, the North Koreans have done nothing material in terms of offering up, putting on the table, based on every news report I've seen, anything that has to do with literally the status, the inventory, the operational capability of the nuclear forces, that is the delivery systems and the nuclear weapons inventory that they have. It's absolutely impossible to conclude any sort of serious arms control agreement unless you literally have the facts on the table. And the way in which the North Koreans have approached the agreement has basically been to sell the same bridge multiple times over, whether it's destroying Yongbyon or whether it's blowing up obsolete nuclear weapons test sites, or whether it's claiming that they'll do the best they can after American and international sanctions are lifted. We've seen this movie before. The results have proven to be utterly barren, and we're walking down the same path towards that same outcome again. The second thing I would say is that the North Koreans have read very well the total dysfunction of this administration. Over the past 7-8 months in Singapore, they have not only stiffed the so-called special representative, Mr. Begin, who was appointed by the administration to supposedly be the working-level point man for negotiations, but they've stiffed Secretary of State Pompeo, whose visits to Pyongyang and whose discussions have produced literally nothing in terms of concrete arms control-related responses. What does that tell you? They understand that if they play to the ego and to the media orientation of a president whose substance is lacking, but whose flair for reality TV distinguishes him, needless to say, in comparison to everyone who's ever held the job, they are going to be able to get what they, the North Koreans, want, and that is to continue to slow roll this issue forward, maintaining their nuclear capability and step-by-step establishing that as a nuclear state, they have the de facto, and ultimately this is their goal, the de jure, the official political recognition as such in Asia. It's a huge step forward for them. It's an enormous step backward for us. Not that we aren't willing to deal with a nuclear North Korea, if at the end of the day that's what it comes to, but not at the price that we are now paying, which is literally no movement whatsoever towards serious arms control on the Korean Peninsula.
So, Kent Harrington, what did you make of the exchange of Senator Blumenthal, who had just learned, as we all had from the Financial Times, that Trump had had another secret meeting with Putin at the G20 where there was no U.S. Transcription or record or translator, and it was all entirely done through Putin's translator. And we know that Trump's gone to great lengths to suppress any records of his prior meetings with Putin. So basically what Blumenthal asked of the DNI, you know, how can you guys operate when you don't know what your president has discussed with the Russians? Doesn't that put you at a great disadvantage? And Coates couldn't answer that question. He just said, look, we have to talk about that in closed session. This has got to be, if not embarrassing for them, I mean, have they ever, they've never seen this kind of thing from a leader. You know, I mean, at the Helsinki situation where Trump basically said took Putin's line against the intelligence community by saying that Putin assured him he didn't have anything to do with meddling in our elections, and he believed Putin. I mean, any normal president would have turned and said, "Yes, we know you did it, and don't do it again." But no. So this has led, for example, the Obama administration official Samantha Vinograd to say on CNN today that Trump treats Putin as his shadow advisor. And then the other day, and Nancy Pelosi tweeted out that Putin has some kind of hold over Trump, both personally, politically, and financially.
Well, all I can say is that if this were the equivalent of a Rorschach test, I mean, the only thing I would come up with, if you flashed the word picture you just flashed in front of me, was the adjective appalling. There's no precedent for this in my recollection. I worked in government over the course of almost 30 years under five different presidents, and recognizing very well that there's information that is often very, very tightly held coming from high-level meetings, it's nonetheless shared at levels where it can be used to educate and to ensure that people whose responsibility is to follow countries and problems and programs understand what's transpired at the senior most levels of government. The fact that not only has nothing been shared, but nothing has even been recorded, it really raises enormous questions, not to mention, if you will, red flags. And while I would defer to the House Speaker on what this connotes, her conclusion and whatever she quote-unquote tweeted is not anything but reasonable. More than that, though, it's something that I think is a reflection of an enormous problem we face as a democracy, and that is, what do you do when you have actions taken by the senior most official in government which somehow are unable to be examined or inquired about and raise profound questions about issues of national security? Putin's not our friend. There's no rationale here that makes sense for what's happened over the course of 2 years with the presidential interactions with the Russian leader. And one can only hope that in the inquiries that will move forward on the Hill, as well as the conclusion at whatever point it's reached of the Mueller investigation, that we'll have some insight into this issue. But it is, as I said at the outset, in a word, appalling.
Well, Kent Harrington, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks, Ian. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
And again, I've been speaking with Kent Harrington, who is a former senior CIA analyst who was National Intelligence Officer for East Asia and Chief of Station in Asia. And he has an article at Project Syndicate, Trump's North Korean Road to Nowhere. We're going to take a brief station break and be back looking into fissures inside the Trump-Fox feedback loop.
Television rules the nation.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Matt Goetz, who is a senior fellow at Media Matters, where he writes extensively on media ethics and the Trump-Fox feedback loop. He served as the organization's research director during the 2016 election cycle, and his latest article at Media Matters is Trump's Propagandists Go to War with Each Other After He Caves on the Shutdown. Welcome to Background Briefing, Matt Goetz.
Thanks so much for having me.
And Matt, it seems that there's the Trump supporters in the media, his cheer squad, the Fox, Breitbart, Blue Dobbs, there seem to be some fissures there, but not for the right reasons. Not as if they're figuring out that Trump is a fraud and he's not delivered on his promises, but rather they seem to be attacking him for the wrong reasons. So when you keep looking for cracks in the 30-plus percent Trumpsters who seem to be absolutely zealously glued to his support and seem to be impervious to facts and evidence, what are we to make of what fissures exist at this point?
Well, certainly I think that that there are fissures at all is a bit of a change. Normally this crowd is 100% united behind him, no matter what happens. But the shutdown, I think, did cause a bit of a schism. I don't know how long it'll last, and I think there are probably some ways for him to get back from it. But, you know, this was a shutdown that was really, in many ways, caused by Fox News. They have been trying for months and months to get him to shut down the government as a way of getting leverage to build a wall on the southern border. And in December, it finally sort of came to pass. There was this moment where it looked like the White House was going to cave and accept government funding without wall money. And when Fox heard that, the usual set of commentators began warning the president, you can't do this, you can't give in. If you do this, you're never going to get the wall. It's going to be a huge loss for you personally. And he listened to them, and he shut down the government, and he kept it shut down for 35 days. But finally, he sort of had to bend to reality. It looked like Republican senators were going to abandon him because the polling was so bad, and it looked like we could be in for some real disasters with the airlines. And so he gave in. He reopened the government, and there's been a pretty big divide. There's sort of a handful of commentators who are basically saying that he abandoned their principles, he abandoned the wall, that it's a huge disaster for him. And then you have this other set that's basically saying, no, actually, he didn't lose at all. He just hasn't won yet, and he's still going to win, and everyone just needs to calm down and sort of stay the course, and eventually he will emerge victorious.
So, Matt Goetz, since you study right-wing media, and you mentioned that there's been some fissures in the wall of support for Donald Trump because of the shutdown, but, you know, mostly, I guess, it's sort of the Ann Coulters of the world, the idea that he's the macho man is being whipped by the woman that they hate so much, Nancy Pelosi. I don't think they hate us quite as much as Hillary Clinton, but she's certainly up there in the world of right-wing demonization. So what's your sense of then how in the next phase, when we get to mid-February, when, and I mean, I don't know that these negotiations are going to go anywhere, but assuming they don't, he's going to shut down the government again or declare a national emergency. So what are the right-wing cheer squad on Fox going to do? They already dug a hole for him last time. Are they going to dig another hole for him with a emergency declaration?
I think that's probably where this is going. You know, for the last couple of weeks, really, the one thing that has united these two separate factions has been this claim that the national emergency is the way to go, that the only way to really guarantee that the wall will happen is for the president to declare a national emergency and use that to move funding from other buckets in the government into the wall. Now, legal experts are pretty skeptical of this. They seem to think that, you know, declaring something a national emergency on the basis of the fact that you haven't been able to pass legislation in Congress is not terribly strong and might not hold up in court. But it's a way to move it off the table, at least in the short to medium term, and perhaps get the government funded for a longer period of time without having these sorts of Republican intransigence causing lots of problems. So I think the national emergency is probably going to end up being what happens, unless there's some sort of legislative breakthrough that I am very skeptical about.
And again, I'm speaking with Matt Gaetz, who's a senior fellow at Media Matters, where he writes extensively on media ethics and the Trump-Fox feedback loop. He served as the organization's research director during the 2016 election cycle, and his latest article at Media Matters is Trump's Propagandists Go to War with Each Other After He Caves on the Shutdown. So what explains, then, the adherence to Trump in the face of all this evidence? Now, I don't imagine the people who watch Fox watched the intelligence chiefs on Tuesday contradict more or less everything that Trump says in terms of his foreign policy achievements and his focus and policies. That was pretty devastating. So what if Fox, do they show any of this stuff? I mean, I'm trying to figure out why it is that none of this evidence of Trump's incompetence gets through to them when every day we just learn more and more how unfit this guy is for the job.
Yeah, I mean, generally speaking, it's because they're not going to report that. They're giving a very slanted view of the news that focuses on Trump's purported successes on and that basically portrays any sort of negative story about him as the result of some sort of either the fake news media or the deep state conspiring against him or what have you. And so that sort of news is just not going to break through on any real level. It's going to be filtered out pretty strongly by the right-wing commentators on that network.
So the Foxconn story that's coming out now, all of Trump's promises about this big Foxconn plant in Wisconsin look like they're sort of fading, with indications that Foxconn is probably going to back out of the promises.
Yeah, I mean, a story like that is not going to show up on, Fox News primetime, certainly. It's not going to show up probably on Fox and Friends, which is the morning program that the president loves so much. It's probably not going to show up, but I have not seen it all day today. It has not been mentioned on Fox's airwaves, as far as I can tell. That is not something that they're going to tell their audience about. They're not going to level with them about the president's incompetence. They're going to explain that actually he's doing a fantastic job. And the problem is that, the forces arrayed against him.
Well, what happens when Mueller comes out, and assuming all of the rumors we hear about Russian collusion, and particularly the tweet from Nancy Pelosi the other day saying, what does Putin have over Donald Trump personally, politically, and financially? That's an extraordinary thing for the Speaker of the House to say. So what happens if we find out that not only is this guy a criminal, but he's a traitor? Will that news ever get through to these people?
I don't know. And obviously, I don't know what Mueller's going to come out with. I think what's already sort of public information is pretty devastating and should be pretty devastating to the president. But, I mean, the reality here is that there's been a very careful effort by Fox News to build a counter-narrative against the Mueller probe, dating back basically since its inception. There's been this very complicated conspiracy theory that's been woven by the network's hosts and guests claiming that the real story of the Mueller investigation is that it shows that the deep state was, out to get Trump during the campaign, and that the whole thing is, sort of the fruit of a poisoned tree can't be believed. And then, this is happening even as Mueller puts away a series of the president's close associates from that campaign. But, Fox is doing whatever it can to minimize the impact of that. I mean, when you think about Fox News, you really have to go back to Richard Nixon, because Fox was founded by Roger Ailes, who was a Nixon aide who saw Nixon go down during Watergate and basically created Fox as a way to change the media environment so that it would be more favorable to Republicans. Richard Nixon didn't have Fox News to support him during his scandals, but Donald Trump does, and it's a very powerful propaganda force that's going to do whatever it can to help him.
So when Roger Stone today calls out to the right-wing media, I think he was on Breitbart, saying there's a bullet heading straight for Donald Trump, that they're out to get him, and he's not fighting back sufficiently, are they going to rally? I mean, when you talk about the right-wing media having developed this deep state scenario, did they miss the fact that a member of the deep state, the head of the FBI, more than anybody, helped elect Trump? I mean, that's what Hillary Clinton believes.
Right. That's the sort of the thing that undermines the entire conspiracy theory is there were two investigations that were run by the FBI during the campaign. One of them was very, very public and targeted Hillary Clinton, and one was kept entirely secret and targeted Donald Trump. So, you know, if the FBI was conspiring to get Trump, you'd think they would have told some people about it before he was elected. The whole thing doesn't make any sense at all, but that doesn't mean that they're going to stop doing it. They're going to keep up the same effort night in and night out, and, you know, that's how propaganda outlets work.
And again, I'm speaking with Matt Gaetz, who's a senior fellow at Media Matters, where he writes extensively on media ethics and the Trump-Fox feedback loop. He served as the organization's research director during the 2016 election cycle, and his latest article at Media Matters is Trump's propagandists go to war with each other after he caves on the shutdown. Well, I'm just tearing my hair out here trying to figure out how do we have some kind of consensus about what's true and what's real in this country? Are we just going to continue with this sort of divide in post-truth America between those that believe the fake news of Fox News but actually believe the fake news that Fox News propagates that the rest of the media is fake news? I mean, it's a pretty clever ruse on their part.
Yeah, I think it's very hard. I think you've got, you know, 30%, maybe a third of the country that have completely tuned out the mainstream media whatsoever, that just think that it's all a bunch of lies and they just don't listen to it and don't believe it, and they have their own media outlets that tell them what they want to hear. And that's just the way it is right now. I don't know how you shake that up.
Yeah, but that's across the board. I mean, liberals go to MSNBC for the same reason. Christians go to Christian Broadcasting to hear their hermetically sealed version of reality. Everybody's doing reality shopping. It's not just a product of the right.
It's a little bit different, though, on the left. On the left, what you tend to see is support for a lot of different outlets, mainstream ones as well as more liberal ones. On the right, you really just see support for right-wing outlets. It's a much more closed loop on that side than it is on the left. And also, I think that a network like MSNBC just has a stronger connection to the reality-based community than Fox does. The standards are higher.
Right. They do practice journalism, that's for sure. And that's fundamentally different than being a propaganda outlet for a sitting government, which is actually something that's very un-American. And again, that's where I'm trying to figure this out. What about these patriots? What about these people who believe in defending the country? The idea that Trump is playing footsie with the enemy, he's having secret meetings with Putin and nobody knows what they discuss. And if Mueller comes out with evidence that he's a traitor, you know, you were saying that they won't break from Trump. So something's happened here, and it's happened to the Republican Party, too. They used to be the Cold Warriors and the Red Baiters and the Russian haters. So something's happening. I mean, I don't know whether it's Deripaska's money has ended up in McConnell's pocket or whatever it is, but do you have any ideas about why this change from the party of hawks to the party of, what I know, fellow travelers?
I mean, I think that in large part, they like what they're getting from President Trump, and so they're not going to look too hard at any of this. I think that a lot of the senators and congressmen think, okay, well, we got our big tax cut. We're getting our judges. If we need to support Trump in order to keep this stuff coming, then we'll just take on the risk of whatever's happening with Russia. But that's just sort of, it's a price that they're willing to pay, I guess.
Well, just in closing, the strangest part of this is that we know that Trump spends most of his day watching TV. He's got this little office off the Oval Office where he's got a bank of TVs. And it would be the equivalent of an actor not being interested in the performance but only interested in the reviews, because he doesn't really do the job. He doesn't know how to do the job, but he continually watches for what they say about how he's doing the job. And then he adjusts himself and comes up with the latest reality TV stunt, either to distract the press from the fact that he doesn't know what he's doing or to just simply keep the game going, trying to stay one step ahead of the sheriff in terms of manipulating the media. So that's the reality. So he watches TV, he gets mad at stuff that he sees on CNN, and then he goes to get comfort from Fox. So do the Fox people understand that they really have an audience of one, that they really, you know?
They 100% understand that. You know, if you watch Fox as much as I do, what you see is them directing points directly to him. They're trying to influence his decision-making process. They're saying, Mr. President, do this, Mr. President, do that. And they are having influence. They are, in some places, shifting the president's priorities, giving him ideas, and that's how you end up with this shutdown.
Well, Matt Goetz, I thank you for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Matt Goetz, who's a senior fellow at Media Matters, where he writes extensively on media ethics and the Trump-Fox feedback loop. He served as the organization's research director during the 2016 election cycle, and his latest article at Media Matters is Trump's Propagandists Go to War with Each Other After He Caves on the Shutdown. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now. Lady dressed in white with a man she loves.